And we'll get back to more of From the Cream to the Dregs, but now it's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night, and it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use for the next half hour. We're going to bring you news and announcements of an environmental nature. And let's start off with an announcement for the California Native Plant Society. Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team is going to be having a restoration this Saturday, April 18th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. We will be doing some tidying up of prior French broom work sites, making sure we have not missed any broom which could flower and set seed. This year we have accomplished a lot, and there is still more to do, but for now, maintaining our current work sites is the best thing that can happen until next fall. Chuck will be leading this work party, so come on out and show your support. Our spring plant sale is this Saturday as well, so drop on by there. I'll have more information about that in a second. To get to Quail Hollow Ranch at 10 a.m. this Saturday, take Graham Hill Road north from Santa Cruz. As you come down the hill into Felton, turn right at the light and go on up East Ziani Road. About 2 miles, you'll turn left on Quail Hollow Road. A half a mile up on the right is the entrance to Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. They'll meet in the gravel parking lot on the left side of the entrance road. And the UCSC Arboretum and the California Native Plant Society are having their spring plant sale. And that's this Saturday, April 18th, from noon to 4, and it's open to the public. I think for members of the Native Plant Society and the UCSC Arboretum, it's open earlier. But since you're only a member of the public, don't come until noon. This sale is held at the Arboretum's Eucalyptus Grove, which is at the intersection of High and Western Drive. And Santa Cruz, membership in either the UCSC Arboretum or the California Native Plant Society Santa Cruz County Chapter will be available at the gate on the date of the sale. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitats and in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. This program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. We work rain or shine. But if things get particularly shiny, as they might this Saturday, they'll call it a day. Don't count on that. Tools are provided. Bring water and gloves. So check that, folks, out. I don't have any contact information because Linda's out of town, so there. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Yellowstone Rangers hazed a small mixed group of buffalo that were a few miles inside the park border near Gardner, Montana. Over the past 2 weeks, these buffalo have been moving within the park in the areas of Powerline Flats and Shooter Flats, the former marking the zone where management actions are triggered. We are hopeful of these buffalo will find satisfaction in the grasses a little deeper inside the park so they are not harassed any longer. Horse Butte is again teeming with buffalo everywhere we look. There's a group of buffalo grazing, playing, and enjoying their time unmolested by buffalo harassing agents. It's encouraging to see how healthy the buffalo look, and it shows in their playfulness with one another. It's been really amazing for us to see them move the way they want to, on their own terms, coming to the butte, disappearing in one morning, only to return again a few days later with many more friends. Not all the buffalo that migrate toward Horse Butte have made it, however. On Saturday night and again during the dark and early hours of Monday morning, at least 15 buffalo were struck and consequently killed while trying to cross Highway 191 on their way to Horse Butte. Astoundingly, no humans were hurt in these collisions, but people may not always be so lucky. Some of the buffalo were killed on impact, while others survived with injuries so severe that one local resident and agents from the Department of Livestock and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks shot them to end their suffering. Patrols suspect that there are a couple of other injured buffalo that have eluded the agents' gunshots to find a quiet place to die alone. We are keeping an eye out for them, but we hope their suffering is over and that they are undiscovered, so should they die, they help sustain bears, wolves, and ravens rather than being transported by officials to the local dump. Bison are nearly impossible to see in the dark due to their dark coloration and their non-reflective eyes. They do not fear and bound across the road as other animals do. They take their time to graze along the highway where, due to plowing, some of the first grasses appear after the long winter. Sometimes they even choose to bed down on the warm asphalt that has been dissecting their migratory path. In the dark, people never see the bison on the road until it's too late, especially if they're traveling at excessively high speeds, as was the case in three separate incidents this week. You, dear Buffalo supporters, have helped us save countless buffalo lives along the highway by enabling us to purchase professional warning signs that alert motorists to the presence of bison on the road. Over the past few years, the use of these signs has prevented more bison and possibly human injuries and deaths than we can imagine. In years past, Buffalo Field Campaign was instrumental in getting the Montana Department of Transportation to erect marquee signs that warn of bison on the highway, and we were successful in getting the speed limits lowered from 70 to 55 miles per hour along Highway 191 from Fir Ridge to West Yellowstone, the 10-mile stretch of asphalt in the middle of the bison's migration corridor. Bison frequently cross this busy road to get to other favored habitat. However, the Montana Department of Transportation has changed the signs to read animals on highway instead of bison on highway, which is much less effective, and the speed limit has not been strictly enforced. Take action. If you are a Montana resident, a visitor to Yellowstone, if you or your loved ones travel through this region, or if you simply love wild bison, your voice is critical. Please contact the Montana Department of Transportation and Montana Governor Brian Switzer, strongly urging them to make highways safer for America's last wild bison and the people who travel through this region. With the buffalo's migration finally underway, we are in need of volunteers for both spring and summer. Buffalo Field Campaign is looking for folks in our spring field season and for the summer months when volunteers run our outreach tables in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. We are also looking for a maintenance coordinator who is mechanically inclined and can help keep our vehicles and cabins in running order. Buffalo Field Campaign provides room, board, and training, and we can outfit you with the necessary gear. This time of year, and with the long hours, food is a needed friend for our tireless volunteers. We could use donations of coffee, hot chocolate, dark is great, energy bars, fruit bars, candy, hot apple cider mix, chips, crackers, jam, and peanut butter. To donate any or all of these items, send them to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Once again, that address for donations, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. If you wish to volunteer, please go to their webpage first. That's at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org and read all about becoming a Buffalo Field Campaign volunteer and everything that entails and their rules and regulations. And before you go, be sure to give them a call at area code 406-646-0070. I'm sorry to emphasize those points, but be a responsible volunteer. Figure out what kind of volunteer they're looking for before you just drop in on them. Do remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And Russia has banned the hunt for young harp seals. This from the Environment News Service. A ban on the hunting of all harp seals less than 1 year old was announced by the Russian government. The ban was imposed by the Russian Federal Fisheries Agency, and the documentation has been sent for state registration with the Ministry of Justice, RIA Novosti reports. The bloody seal slaughter, the killing of the defenseless animals, which can't even be called a hunt, is now prohibited in Russia as it is in most developed countries, Canada being the exception. It is a serious step towards the conservation of biodiversity in Russia, said Minister of Natural Resources and Ecology Yuriy Trutnev. public opposition to the Russian harp seal hunt has grown over the past year. International Fund for Animal Welfare's Anna Filipova said the anti-hunting demonstrations held in 25 Russian cities and abroad have helped people gain greater understanding of the issues involved in seal hunting. The public outcry led to mounting pressure on the Russian government to close the harp seal hunt. Trutnev thanked non-governmental organizations and the public for supporting passage of the ban, saying NGOs actively upheld their position against this hunt, raised public awareness, and by all means contributed to the passage of the ban on the seal hunt in Russia. Environmentalists were happy with the government's decision. The end of Russia's harp seal hunt was applauded by the International Fund for Animal Welfare, which has been working in Canada and throughout the world to put an end to commercial seal hunts. We are overwhelmingly pleased that the Russian government has finally completed its pledge to protect harp seals, said Masha Vorosova, director of IFAW Russia. The time has now come for the Canadian government to follow suit and end their cruel hunt for harp seals once and for all, said Vorostova. These hunts are unnecessary. They are merely supporting the trade in fur used for non-essential fashion items. We are delighted at the adoption of this decision and would like to separately underline the important role played by the Russian Natural Resources Ministry in this case. Thanks to their efforts, this has finally taken place. Being a state structure, it greatly influenced the advancement of this process, said Filipova. The government-subsidized Russian harp seal hunt took place in early spring in the White Sea off the coast of Russia, an area known as the East Ice. The Seal Conservation Society, based in Northern Ireland, says the main product of the Russian hunt has been the white fur pelts of very young seals, which are then dyed black for sale as hats, for which there is little demand. Although the European Union currently maintains a ban on the importation of harp seal white coat products, an environmental group found evidence that the ban is not being enforced and that white coat products have been entering the European Union through Russia through Norway. It has been reported that many people participating in the Russian hunt work in conditions of virtual slavery and are being forced by their employer to take part in the hunt or lose their jobs, no alternative jobs being available, the Seal Commission Society said. There are two sealing concessions for the Russian hunt, sealers using helicopters to reach the seal on the ice and killing the pups by clubbing them. The number of pups killed by Russian sealers in 1999 was 34,850, all of them the very young white-coated seals. Environmental groups have been trying to promote ecotourism and small business as alternatives to the Russian seal hunt. Later that week, the world's largest seal hunt began off the east coast of Canada. Last year, more than 217,000 harp seals were killed. 99.8% of them were under 3 months of age. Canada does not allow the clubbing of white coats. Sealers must wait until the animals get their darker gray coats at about 6 weeks of age. But around the world, opposition is mounting to annual seal hunts in Canada, where most of the world's seal hunting takes place, as well as Greenland, Namibia, and Norway. On March 2nd, the European Parliamentary Committee voted to ban products derived from seals from being imported into the European Union, exported from it, or even transported through a EU territory. The full European Parliament is to vote on the ban on April 1st at the plenary session in Russia, in Brussels, excuse me. And I haven't heard word about that, but we'll try and figure this out. The story obviously being a week or two old. The measure must also be approved by EU governments before it can be implemented. Seals are hunted mainly for their pelts, but also for meat and fat, which is used in beauty products. Sea Shepherd Conservation Society and Lush Cosmetics, which makes only plant-based products, announced a new partnership to oppose Canada's commercial hunt to launch the campaign in the Queen Street store in Toronto, Ontario. Lush employee Christy Kay stripped off her clothes, painted herself red, and lay on a bloody Canadian flag to symbolize the 1,000 seals that would be killed and skinned during this year's hunt. As a business that cares about animals and the environment, we are ashamed that the blood continues to flow on the ice of eastern Canada, said Mark Wolverton, North American CEO of Lush Cosmetics. Clubbing and shooting baby seals for their fur is cruelty to animals, plain and simple, and Lush Cosmetics wants to see it stopped. Lush has created a new bubble bar in the shape of a baby seal for this campaign with Sea Shepherd. This sea vegetable soap bar is called First Swim because many of the seals slaughtered are so young they have not yet had their first swim. 100% of the proceeds of the bubble bar are going to the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society to support the organization's practice of placing its conservationists between the seal hunters and the seals. The Canadian government, on the other hand, maintains that the annual hunt is an essential part of the marine economy and that it is humane. Patrice Simon, a biologist with the Fisheries and Oceans Canada, said that seals are not skinned alive. Several independent studies by European and Canadian veterinary researchers have concluded that seals were indeed dead when they were skinned. They may sometimes still seem alive because they have a reflex and continue to move following death, he said. But the Humane Society International points out that veterinarians have studied Canada's commercial seal hunt for 5 decades and have consistently found high levels of suffering. Veterinary experts say commercial seal hunting is inherently inhumane because of the remote, extreme environments in which hunts operate and the speed at which they must be conducted, the organization says. This is a primary reason why nations around the world are taking action on behalf of their citizens to end the trade in seal products. And moving to a logging story here. Temporary roads are like low-fat ice cream in this story by George Werthner. The latest attempt by the Forest Service to make logging palatable is temporary roads. A lot of research has found that logging roads are among the biggest impacts to forest ecosystems. The Forest Service has at least 400,000 miles of roads on land it administers, and these roads are a major environmental collateral impact associated with logging and other resource exploitation. Even though the Forest Service has had to admit that logging roads have many unacceptable impacts to the forest ecosystem, so they have come up with a new term and idea to make logging acceptable, temporary roads. Temporary roads would have temporary impacts, or so we are led to believe. Temporary roads are like low-fat ice cream. They seem to taste good, but as any nutritionist can tell you, they are infinitely better off if you don't consume a lot of ice cream at all, low-fat or otherwise. The same is true for roads. Temporary roads are only slightly better than a regular road, and no one should be fooled into thinking they somehow eliminate the negative impacts associated with roads just because they are temporary. The problem is that temporary roads have most of the same environmental impacts as regular roads. All roads compact the soil. Even 3 trips by logging equipment over soil can result in a significant reduction in water infiltration. Roads by slicing across slopes alter the downward flow of subsurface and surface water, often concentrating it on the compacted road surface, thus increasing the erosive power of the water. Roads are a chronic source of sedimentation and a major impact on aquatic ecosystems. Roads also fragment wildlife habitat. Roads are avoided by some sensitive wildlife species or used as a convenient travel corridor by other species. Often roads provide access for weedy species that negatively impact other species, such as creating access for edge birds to invade and attack interior forest species. Roads change the airflow, which can affect fire spread and even the distribution of plants responding to microclimate changes. Roads are a major vector for weeds and disease. Weeds and disease are one of the most pernicious and problematic impacts associated with roads. In the long term, the introduction of weeds and disease may do more damage to forests than the logging. For instance, a root fungus that is introduced by logging equipment along roads is decimating Port Orford cedar stands in Oregon and California, where the trees grow. Roadbeds also provide access for hikers and hunters, giving more potential disturbance to wildlife, and ORVers typically find ways to get around gates and other obstacles to use roads as, well, roads. In short, a temporary road is mostly a mirage. It is essentially a new logging road. Now, some will argue that temporary roads are better than regular roads, especially if they are reclaimed. If a road is fully reclaimed, there is something to this argument. The problem is that there are no legal definitions of what constitutes a reclaimed road. And most roads are not fully reclaimed, in part because it is very difficult and very expensive to do full reclamation. To fully reclaim a road is more than putting up a gate to block vehicle travel. It requires ripping up the roadbed to remove the compacted soil layers. The side slope soil has to be put back onto the road and reshaped so that the subsurface and surface water flow is restored. Culverts need to be removed and stream channels fully restructured and reconstituted. New vegetation needs to be planted, and grass seed is not enough, especially if the area once supported a forest. And rocks and logs and other natural structures need to be put back on the slope. And even if all these things are done, an old road does not magically disappear overnight. It continues to have impacts for years until the vegetation has grown sufficiently to more or less emulate the pre-eroded condition. I've seen fully reclaimed roads in Redwood National Park and a few other places, and it is extremely rare. And the expense often numbers in the hundreds of thousands of dollars per mile. By contrast, I've seen a lot more minimally reclaimed roads. I've been on Forest Service lands where a temporary road is just a road that the Forest Service didn't put on its travel maps as a legal road. It was still there on the ground, and since it was not included in the official travel plan as a road, as far as the Forest Service was concerned, the road did not exist any longer. The Forest Service usually does go a step further, however, to close temporary roads. Typically, the agency will put up a gate. Nevertheless, most gates, unless built extremely well, do not keep off-road vehicle users from using the road on the other side, and sometimes even the agency continues to use the road for, quote, administrative purposes. While such temporary roads may reduce road impacts somewhat, there are nowhere as good as no road at all. And this is the rub. I've had environmentalists telling me that I don't have to worry about new logging roads because they are all going to be temporary. For example, that is one of the claims of the Beaverhead Deer Lodge Partnership proponents. Don't worry, all the logging will be from existing roads and any new roads will be temporary and must be removed in 5 years. For one thing, such temporary roads will effectively be a road for 5 years at least and may exist far longer as a marginally reclaimed road, especially in the arid environment found in much of the southwest Montana. Such temporary roads will exhibit nearly all the problems of a regular road, except they may not be used for public vehicle travel. So when you hear someone supporting logging because it won't have the impact of roads since all new roads will be temporary, you better start asking some hard questions about the proposal. How long will the temporary road be in use? Will it be closed to all traffic forever, or will it be used again for logging in 10 or 20 years, maybe? Will it be reclaimed? What reclamation plan will they follow? Will the road be ripped up, slopes restored, stream channels reconstructed, and original vegetation restored? If not, then you will still have a road. And a road is a road, whether it's called a temporary road or whether it's not. Temporary roads may be better than a permanent addition to the road network, but it should never be thought of as zero impact. Remember, low-fat ice cream is still ice cream, and you're not likely to lose weight eating a lot of it. Temporary roads are still roads and typically have all of the major impacts associated with any road. And we thank George Werthner for that opinion. And here's another opinion, this one by Roy Keane. Add private forests to the Forest Summit. The new administration promises to hold a forest summit to seek solutions to an old Northwestern dilemma: how to reconcile the timber economy with the forest environment. The Clinton administration, unlike the previous one, has the vision to suggest that sustained environments can produce sustainable economies. This philosophy is in direct contrast, I think they meant the Obama administration, is in direct contrast to the actions of multinational corporations that have dominated Northwest forest resources for more than a century. Their practice has been to exploit the environment while producing a windfall economy, often at the expense of forest and rural community health. During this era of industrial forestry, the high-volume mature conifer forests have been liquidated in favor of juvenile plantations that have yet to replace the older old-growth forests. The rapid extraction of private saw timber has placed an unfair burden on public forest timber, watersheds, and wildlife. A number of Northwest industrial forest owners are overcutting their lands while purchasing large amounts of public timber. Timber companies that want more national forest timber should expect the public to ask for some reassurance that they will not continue to overcut their own lands. The great multi-ownership forest that covers Northern California, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho is one whole forest in spite of lines drawn on deeds and maps. The private forest is a large and productive component of the Northwestern forests, accounting for 43% of the 63 million acres of overall commercial timberlands. Although less than half of the total acreage, its potential timber production capability exceeds that of the much larger public acreage. Much of the industrial private component is intermingled with federal lands. When the private forest next to public land is overcut, it reduces the public timber harvest potential due to federally observed cumulative impact restrictions. To enjoy stable forest resources such as timber supplies, fisheries, and quality of life, Northwestern forests must be managed holistically and sustainably. In the past, the federal government, assisted by prestigious groups like the Society of American Foresters, has attempted to mandate minimum federal standards of sustainable yield forestry for private forests, similar to those mandated for public lands. Mandated minimal sustained yield forestry is one reason federal lands are less depleted today than comparable private forests. Current state-level private forest regulations vary from progressive in California to primitive in Idaho. With the possible exception of California, Northwestern private forest practice regulations are no more than compromised efforts to minimize logging impacts and, as such, fail to address sustained yield. Sustained yield forestry is the central concept of modern forest science and economics. Continually balancing the growth of timber against the harvest of timber helps to maintain the minimum components of the forest ecosystem that are essential for water quality and wildlife. Practicing good forestry on the federal half of Northwest forests while allowing the private half to be continually overcut only guarantees constant biological and social conflicts. Northwestern forest industries have always favored state over federal private forest regulations. As the unfolding fiasco over Oregon's minimal riparian area rule change illustrates, industry can easily dominate an individual state forestry board and override scientifically defensible efforts to reform archaic legislation. Northwest residents have been unable to resolve this dilemma. We need the outside help that federally mandated sustained yield private forestry rules would provide. This policy should be focused on large holdings and enacted within a body of uniform multi-state sustained yield mandates. These regulations should be drafted by unbiased scientists, foresters, and resource specialists with overview by a multi-interest public board and enforced by state forestry agencies. Private forest owners who violate these sustained yield regulations would be prohibited from purchasing public timber and denied tax reductions and deferrals on their holdings. Reasonable private forest sustained yield regulations would reduce corporate raids and forest liquidations while helping to reconcile timber supplies with forest ecosystem maintenance. Applying uniform multi-state sustained yield regulations to private forests would not be the taking of private property or bad business, just the beginning of good regional forestry. A federal private forest sustained yield mandate could also provide an opportunity for America's new leaders to resolve a regional resource problem in favor of local economies and environments. And we want to thank Roy Keane for that. And it looks like that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update for this week. I want to thank you for listening to the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you would like to hear a podcast of the Earth First Update, please go to the following webpage, www.h2opodcast.com. That's h2opodcast.com. www.h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio. And we thank the folks at h2opodcast.com for recording and providing those podcasts for our listeners. Please tune in next Thursday evening for another Earth First Update. Thank you for listening.